This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Live and Learn. I'm Chua Untik. As the year comes to a close, we are rebroadcasting some of our favourite interviews of the year. On Malaysia Day, Lee Tree Lin spoke to Professor Emeritus Tan Sri Dr. Khoo Kay Kim about the process of decolonization 53 years after the making of the country. Professor Khoo lived through British Malaya, the Japanese occupation, and is a co-author of The Rukun Negara, a set of national principles written in reaction to the 1969 racial riots. Professor Khoo begins with the circumstances around his birth.
Well, I was born before World War II, in 1937 to be precise. And I have always been reminded that that was the year when the Sino-Japanese War began. That was in China. But I lived through the occupation. In fact, my family went into the jungle in Kampa to try to avoid meeting the Japanese. But unfortunately, it was in the Kampa jungle that the British put up a fight against the Japanese. And we were very fortunate to escape. Anyway, when the fighting ceased, we went back to the town. Kampa was, in fact, my maternal grandfather's town. So we were in his house. And there I met the Japanese soldiers, even as a small boy. And I used to watch them every morning doing physical exercises and so on. At that time, I grew to admire them. We went through the Japanese occupation quite all right, because there was always shortage of food, shortage of so many things. But many people may not realize that during the Japanese occupation, the Japanese allowed the amusement parks to go on. You see, in this country before World War II, the amusement parks had been introduced. And then every night, practically the whole town would be there enjoying themselves. And in fact, that was where I watched Chinese opera, Malay Bangsawan. And in fact, I learned my Malay language through watching Bangsawan. So we had a comparatively easy time. I mean, as a young little boy, I need not have to struggle. I didn't go to school because my father didn't send me to the Japanese school. But the Japanese made all the men plant tapioca. So whenever he went to the field to plant tapioca, I would follow him. Then came the trouble at the end of the war. The area near Anson, where I was one of the places where ethnic riots occurred. This was a fighting between the Chinese and the group of Malays called Banja. It started in Batu Pahat and it spread to various parts of the country. And then there was the communist movement. And my father used to come back to the house to tell my mother. So I used to listen. So I learned a lot about what was going on outside the house. Then the British came back. And we were all so excited. We were told that the British soldiers were coming in. So we, as children, we ran to the roads to wait for them, you see. And when they came in, most of them were Indian soldiers. And they threw sweets for us to pick up. And I was very fortunate because by the end of 45, I had already been sent to a school. The British revived the schools very early. From the day I was in school, I was introduced to football. So I became very active for many, many years.
Considering that you lived through three different countries, British Malaya, Federation of Malaya, now Malaysia, growing up and going through those processes, how aware were you of all these kind of notions of national identity and nationhood? Because those are kind of three very different nations.
No, I was, in a sense, very lucky again because my father was a government servant. And government servants those days were given government quarters to stay in. So in the area where I was staying in, my neighbors were made up of various ethnic groups. There were Indians, there were Malays, there was even a Eurasian family. So, and then I went to a school which was, again, multi-ethnic. Tolaenzen at that time was very multi-ethnic. As a result, I don't have ethnic feelings when I grow up, which is why I'm convinced that it's very important to expose young people so that they learn about other cultures. Don't encourage conflict among them. And in my case, although I was exposed for a while because I was studying English in the morning and Chinese in the afternoon, and one of my Chinese teachers was from China. So he was instilling Chinese nationalism in us. But my father held me back. But I learned so much about what was happening in China. And then, as I told you, my father explained to me what was happening outside our homes in Malaya itself. In the end, I'm from day one very conscious of the fact that I was a Malayan. Of course, at that time, there was no Malaysian yet. And I have not changed to this day.
You mentioned, you know, not having necessarily a lot of ethnic feelings. And that is something that's present today.
Yes.
But at the time, what were the forces that shaped society as it was lived? And, you know, as people went about their day, what were the things that kind of shaped their days?
In the outside world, as you say, my father, being a government servant, was not so exposed to such problems. But in the outside world, ethnic problems were already beginning to surface by the 1930s, mainly because most of the non-Malays were not citizens. So they themselves were torn between their country of origin, the countries of origin, and this country, and they didn't know where they were. Like, for example, in my case, my parents were different from me, you see. They were born in Penang, and Penang being a British crown colony, together with Malacca and Singapore, they were British subjects. But they got married in Perak, and I was born in Perak. But at that time, the non-Malays were stateless citizens. So I was a stateless citizen. But luckily, important changes occurred after World War II, and I was able to apply for federal citizenship by 1949 or so.
But did it mean that you grew up thinking of Malaya as home, or did it occur to you that since, you know, you, in a sense, you're a stateless citizen, that there is a possibility for another home somewhere else?
Ah, interesting question. Because my family was very much a Penang Peranakan family. So we were not so closely associated with China as many of the other Chinese. You see. Although, as I said, when I was studying Chinese, the teacher from China used to tell us a lot about China, and we were very fascinated. But we were so used to everything local. Take, for example, the food we used to eat. Penang, very famous for laksa and for char kway teow and so on. Because of that, culturally, I was quite divorced from China.
If I'm not mistaken, you were 26 years old on September 16, 1963. Do you remember what you were doing, what it was like on the day that Malaysia as such came into being?
I was teaching. I went back to my, after I finished my degrees, I went back to my old school in Tolaenzen to teach, mainly because I wanted to be associated with sports. I was already very crazy of sports since school days. So I spent so much of my time coaching the school children in sports. And I was so happy when one of my boys was picked to represent Malaya in the Asian Games in 1962. See? But after coming back with a bronze medal, you see, unlike the athletes of today, whenever they come back with a medal, they are rewarded. My poor pupil, because he missed the fifth form exam because of this sports, when he came back with a bronze medal, he asked the headmaster for permission to repeat his fifth form, and the headmaster said, no, And the poor boy was unemployed for 2 years because of that. And then I felt that it was pointless for me to continue teaching. And that's when I went back to the university to do my master's degree.
When it comes to Malaysia Day, was there any sort of singular, iconic moment? You know, I mean, when we think of Merdeka, we think of yes, course, the Tunku's declarations. When it comes to Malaysia Day, I mean, it's only recently become sort of prominent because it became a public holiday. Suddenly people start thinking about it more. But yeah, in the case of Malaysia Day, was there any kind of iconic memory that comes up of that day?
People did not quite understand what it was. You see, even until today, the people of Sarawak, Sabah and the peninsula are not that close. You ask any peninsular Malaysian about people in Sabah and Sarawak, they will know. But at least in the case of the University of Malaya, in the early years, many of the students in Sabah and Sarawak used to study in the University of Malaya. But after some time, they had their own universities, and now we don't meet anymore. So, and many Malaysians don't realize that the term Malaysia was not used for the first time in 1963.
Oh, when did it come into common parlance?
It used to mean the Malay archipelago. And it was used occasionally in the newspapers, even as early as the 1900s. But in the mid-1930s, there was an American scholar called Rupert Emerson who came up with a book called Malaysia, A Study in Direct and Indirect Rule. So those who went through English schools and were introduced to history and geography had some idea of what Malaysia was all about. But those who did not go to English schools and those who did not study geography and history would have no idea. Even until today, many Malaysians have no idea that the term Malaysia meant the Malay archipelago.
That was Professor Emeritus Tan Sri Dr. Koo Kee Kim speaking to Lee Tree Lin on Malaysia Day. After the break, we will hear about the life and legacy of K. Tambusami Pillay. You are listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon, this is Live and Learn and I'm Chua Eun-Tik. Today, we are revisiting interviews about the making of Malaysia as the year comes to an end. On Federal Territories Day, Lee Tree Lin spoke to Shanta Kumari, the great-granddaughter of K. Tambusami Pillay, a wealthy businessman and philanthropist who was prominent in helping the Indian community during our pre-independence years.
He had 7 children. 3 of them were girls, the 3 eldest, and the rest of them were boys. And my grandfather was the youngest of the youngest of the sons. And he was the most fortunate as well because he lived the longest, whereas the other sons died of health reasons.
When did you become aware of the significance of your great-grandfather's contributions to Malaya? Was it something that you grew up knowing or was it something that you came to realize a little later on?
I grew up knowing it because I was taken to prominent functions with my grandfather. And one of them was the Taipusam Festival. We were just allowed to sit on the grandstand and watch and nothing more than that. We're not supposed to be doing anything else. And the second prominent place that I would go to would be the High Street Temple. And he was the Sanigar, which means like he's the founder and trustee. And that's a title that's handed over. And no other person inherits that title. It's just reserved for the male descendants of the family. So I was very fortunate. I was in school. And after school, he would bring me there. And everything that was politics was discussed there. And even the Indian MIC meeting was held there. And I was very small. I didn't understand what politics was all about. And the rest of it was just photographs. And I would say most of it was what was around the house that I grew up.
When did you begin to ask questions about your great-grandfather and want to know more about? Because I can understand, you know, when you're a young child and you recognize that you're around these sort of major movements and you know that you're meeting important people, but it's only later on, I think, that you think to ask, well, who was that uncle, you know, and who was this person?
Oh, okay, I was always introduced as a great-granddaughter of Tambusami Pillay. So I always felt great And because I was so closely connected with the top people in the country, especially when I was working and I used to visit the Istana, and my director would introduce me, not as a worker from the department, but she's a great-granddaughter of so-and-so. And he would look at me. And then I would start off by saying, yeah, I remember they told me they had horses. They had the best dogs. So, you know, I just grew up with that flair of, you know, things, you know. It was just so easy for me to go along.
Your great-grandfather was born in Singapore. Do you know of the circumstances that took his parents there from India?
Okay, the reason was his father was working for the East India Company. So he brought his son over to Singapore, and he was educated in the Raffles Institution. And he was so good with his English, just like his father. And that played a very important role in his life. And that's one of the reasons why he donated the money for the Victoria Institution, because he knew how important English was, because he was mixing with the top people at that time. So he himself knew the importance of education.
What were his early years there like, aside from being in Raffles Institute?
Oh, okay, he had... I would say, okay, his dad took him around everywhere, which meant that he was always mixing with the army generals. That was the first thing. And when any foreign visitors from Britain arrived, he was there as the interpreter for the Malaysian government at that time. So because of his English, Davidson brought him here to work with him in the, I would say, in the Selangor government department, because he was asked to write the constitution and things like that at that time. So he followed him.
Was it significant that he was appointed the chief accountant or clerk at the Treasury in KL? I would assume that that would have been a position of some trust and some significance.
Exactly. It was, again, he was very grateful for Davidson to have brought him from Singapore and to... When the law was drafted in, I think, 1894, he knew so much about legal matters. And that was a very important role that he was playing. And when Yap Oloy and the Chinese industry started coming up, they did not know how to legalize matters. So they sought the help of this Indian man who could speak English, but he was so intelligent, he had the best friend speaking Chinese as well. So that's how the community, he and Yap Oloy and the rest of the whole community grew up together. Very prominent group of people at that point of time, and they had the money. They had the money.
Are you still in touch with any of, I mean, as you say, that's a prominent group of people. That is a group of people that I think play... It cannot be overstated, a pivotal role in in the early days of KL. Do you keep in touch, or do you know of any descendants of that group of people?
Very fortunate to have met the great-grandson of Yap Oloy, Sydney Yap, who is in New Zealand. And the most wonderful things have happened in his life too, because he got to meet my cousin. And my cousin is the great-grandson of Thambusami Pillay. And they had so much to share because they both came from homes that had the best, I would say, from cutlery to curtains. So they could just remember exactly the whole scenario that they grew up with. But, you know, they were just miles apart, but they never knew each other until they met in a distant shore in New Zealand.
That's such a strange thing, isn't it, to meet somewhere so far removed from your great-grandfathers who knew each other as well.
Exactly.
I read that when there was a shortage of manual workers to work on the Malayan railways and public works sector, your great-grandfather was sent to India by the British government in Malaya to source for people to come work in these fields. Why was he chosen for that task?
Okay, A, he knew the law. He was a prominent Indian here, and he also had contacts in India because of his dad. So he brought in these workers. These workers were mainly for road building, and it was not for rubber tapping. He was very involved in the industry itself. And because he had the money, he had the money, he could afford to take contracts from the government. And one of the very important facts that I need to share was because he was getting involved in privatization at that time, he decided to leave the government service and go into tin mining. And I guess you would know that he was also the first man who introduced electricity in the tin mine. So that was amazing because I didn't know it as well until I came across this article in the TNB magazine. And that's how I knew that he was one of the pioneers who introduced electricity in Malaya.
What interested him in tin mining in particular? I understand that he went into partnership with Loke Yew to become, to do this.
Yes, of course it was money, money, money. Okay, there was this whole lot of Chinaman, and he was an Indian. He was not very good in business, but because of the close proximity in dealing with business, that's how he took up. And he knew he had the expertise, he had the money, and he had the British system of mining. So he brought in the Chinese to introduce pump mining as well in Rawang.
So it's a sharing of expertise then. I'm not good at business, you are, so we learn from each other.
Yes, exactly. As the as I would say that the Chinese didn't have all the legal dispute in place, so he knew the legal matters and how it should be done. So that's how he, the Chinese were involved with him. So it was a whole journey that these two communities, you know, grew.
That was Shanta Kumari speaking to Lee Chui Lin about her great-grandfather, the late K. Tamusami Pillai. Pauline Fan and Yana Rizal are editors of Kisah, a bilingual literary journal which explores the historical and contemporary narrative traditions of Malaysia and Southeast Asia. They told Lee Chui Lin about the inspiration behind the journal.
We actually came up with the idea to do this journal. It was in conjunction with a festival that was happening in Iskandar Puteri, which was called the Narrative Festival. And we were discussing that wouldn't it be a wonderful thing to actually come up for this event and for the longer term, a bilingual literary journal that explores what the idea of the narrative is in very imaginative ways, also challenging the idea of the narrative, responding to it, taking inspiration from it, and exploring the narrative traditions that exist in Malaysia and in Southeast Asia.
What is the role of the literary journal in on somebody's bookshelves? You know, so you have books, you have fiction, non-fiction, you have things of that nature, you have compendiums. Where do literary journals kind of slot in somebody's reading experience?
I think, you know, with this particular journal, what we envision it to be is a kind of a collection of, again, you know, not just a particular idea of what a narrative is, but also to try and see where we can push the boundaries of particular genres and how we understand it at the moment. So this particular journal serves as a kind of a flavor as to what narratives have to offer, we have to offer in this particular region. So I think it's a very interesting experience as you flip from the front to back. There's not a particular thematic thing that we, you know, in the way that we arrange this journal. It's meant to give you a different feel every time you flip through the pages. So
yeah, and I think literary journals in general, they do occupy quite a different place than a book or non-fiction book or a fiction book. Or it's something, sometimes you feel like it's something still in process. Usually, if you read poetry that's in a journal, sometimes it comes from a poet who's possibly not yet done an entire collection. It's a place of discovery. I really find that literary journals, in general, the world over, are places of discovering both the old and the new. And so sometimes you discover things from the archives, you discover things that have been forgotten, or you discover a different aspect of a very well-known writer. Other times, you discover something completely, somebody completely unheard of, a completely new voice. That is really exciting about literary journals.
And I'm going to admit that I'm struggling with saying, okay, narrative, where is the emphasis on this? Because, of course, when you say it in English, it's narrative. But that's not a natural kind of, that's not a natural emphasis in Malay. And here it's narrative kisah. I don't know if I'm getting that right. Where does the name come from?
Well, to be perfectly honest with you, our suggestion for the title of this journal was Kisah. That was our first choice. Kisah really comes from the Malay word for tale, stories. So I think that really encapsulates the idea behind this journal because, again, you know, we wanted to look at this term of kisah and narrative and how do we kind of imagine it again? But the thing is, because this was also done in conjunction with the Iskarnival Festival in Johor, therefore, you know, the word narrative our sponsors felt was very important to be also included as part of the journal.
For the identity.
Yeah. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, it also kind of encapsulates this kind of bilingual feel as well, because narrative is a bit more of an English, you know, in terms of its origins, whereas Kisah is very... very grassroots, very Nusantara.
Yeah, and the word Kisah actually, I mean, it's used in the oral tradition a lot, and that's why we actually love it. It's actually Professor Mohammad Haji Saleh at the launch was saying that actually it's a Persian word in origin. Mm. We probably got it from the Arabic, but it's Persian in origin. But also Kisah, when you think back in the written literary tradition in Malaysia, you go back to things like the Kisah Pelayaran Abdullah. Mm. So, you know, the Hikayat Abdullah of going to the East Coast, and those kinds of journeys and voyages of discovery.
Mm. So there's a very rich connotation attached to Kisah. In fact, our epilogue, if you open the first page, it says, Maka tersebutlah Kisah. Mm. So, yeah.
And when it comes to this notion of the story, of the tale, what would you say is the power of narrative or of the story in terms of telling us a little bit more about the world in which we occupy?
Well, I think, especially in these particular regions, when we talk about narrative here, our history is actually a lot embedded in our oral traditions, which is also a form of narrative, albeit it's not a written kind of narrative. It's passed through the oral traditions. But, you know, so much of our understanding of how we are as a people are actually embedded within these stories. So these are actually the very important things. And therefore, you know, what we try to do here is also to capture some of that oral traditions and transform it in written form, but also to have a little bit of a retelling of our myths in this particular region. So you'll find in there, for example, the Kisah of Badang, which is actually written in like three different versions of that. Because, of course, when you talk about these myths, right, there will always be different versions of that particular myth. So,
yeah. The other thing about narrative traditions, of course, there's in the more modern or modernist setting or contemporary reality, the way we tell stories about ourselves, also the way I think writers have insisted on writing, it's usually to tell, it may not necessarily be to tell a story, but you always have a kind of voice and you do think about what that is that you want to say. So it's an instinctive thing, whether you're in the oral tradition or in the written tradition, it's what are you bringing to your audience and what are you bringing not... Even if you're not thinking about the audience, what are you bringing to the piece of paper that you are, or your art?
Yeah.
With all these different stories being told, and with, as you say, this rich, very varied tradition, that's what we have, is there a singular identity that you can identify in this journal, or is it also as much of a mishmash as we are?
I think the region itself is a bit of a, you know, if it's a bit of a mix, you know, I don't think it's in our position to try to dictate what that particular identity is.
But I think certain things did emerge as we were looking, because we did call, we had an open call for submissions. We received about over 200 submissions, and from which we extracted and selected about 56. And we also invited some established writers to contribute to the journal. But there are certain things that emerge, not because we told them to, but because just sort of naturally certain things recur and emerge. And some of those things, I think there is a kind of, especially among the younger writers, they do seem to be searching for things in history, but in a very, very interesting ways, not necessarily. And I think none of them actually are looking at linear history anymore. Yep. And really, all of them took a very creative approach and a very probing and questioning approach to history. Yeah. Some of them just searching, some of them focusing on particular events or occurrences, as others actually just looking at a kind of more of an identity that came from their ancestors.
Yeah, kind of like a struggle with cultural identity, if you will. You know, there was this particular fiction about her experience with Bomos, right? Of course, you know, when we think about Bomo, we have a certain perception of how Bomos are. But again, in this story, she gives a different light to how this particular Bomo that she encountered is a bit different to how we normally understand as Bomos and things like that. So,
Do we need a lot of context in order to pick up on the cues and the stories that are being told, since it is a regional journal? And some things will, of course, be very intimately familiar, and other things will be, you know, glancingly familiar, while others might just be, you know, something that you've never heard of at all.
I think not necessarily. I think most of the creative work does speak for itself. And one thing, there's a few things that probably need a little bit more explanation, but those have been contextualized. Like, for example, there is an excerpt of a hikayat from Aceh that has been, there's an excerpt of a translation into English. And that needed a bit of contextualization. So the translator actually did give quite an extensive note contextualizing what this interesting hikayat was about. And interestingly, it was about the relationship between the Kingdom of Aceh, Johor, and Pahang at the time, when they were in kind of rivalry.
I think, you know, where it needs to be contextualized, we have tried our best to kind of put a context to it as well. But you're right in saying that, you know, there are particular aspects or pieces in this journal that may be a little bit harder for us to understand. For example, the Iban poems, right? So because a lot of the names that were written there are not particularly familiar to us over in the Semenanjung. But again, you know, we try to be as inclusive as possible to try to get people to kind of think and also search, okay, what is this? What is this particular narrative about? So from there, it sets as a platform.
And one thing I think is also, I think we wanted to encourage the audience or the readers also, when in reading sometimes poetry, to take that same kind of the position of, if you're listening to an oral tradition, you don't necessarily have to understand every single word that's being said. And in the same way, I think sometimes when you read something, sometimes, especially if it's poetry, you can just allow yourself to appreciate the tone of the language, the music of the language, without having to deconstruct every single word.
That was Pauline Fan and Yana Rizal, editors of the literary journal Kisah. If you'd like to listen to any of the interviews featured today in full, you can do so by downloading the BFM app on your iOS or Android device and search for the podcast. You've been listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.